This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new policy on gays in the military goes into effect October 1st. My guest, Congressman Barney Frank, is one of two openly gay members of the U.S. Congress. He opposed the ban on gays in the military, but was willing to accept a compromise which would have allowed gays to express their sexuality only when they were off duty. But the new policy states that homosexual conduct on base or off base is grounds for discharge. In the past, military investigations into sexual orientation have been compared to witch hunts. The new policy says inquiries can only be initiated when there is credible information that there's a basis for discharge. We invited Congressman Frank to talk with us about being a gay member of Congress during the debate. Frank is a Democrat from Massachusetts who served in the House since 1980. President Clinton says the new policy provides a sensible balance between the rights of the individual and the needs of our military to remain the world's number one fighting force. I asked Congressman Frank if he sees the new policy as an advancement.
I do, but I don't agree with the president's statement, and I do wish he hadn't said that. I don't blame Bill Clinton for the fact that those of us who wanted a complete lifting of the ban didn't have the political strength to succeed. Compromise is sometimes inevitable in politics. The big mistake, though, is to try and talk people into believing that you hadn't compromised. I think it was Hannah Arendt who said that the problem with choosing the lesser evil is sometimes you forget that you've still chosen evil. And I think that's applicable in this case. It's not a good policy. It is a less bad policy than the one we've had in this sense. If it is carried out in the spirit in which the president and his chief aides have promulgated it, and as I believe at least the leadership of the Joint Chiefs have promulgated it, in practice it will mean a good deal less harassment and oppression for gay men and lesbians. That is, it is not a policy which represents any great improvement in theory, but the way they have structured it, with restrictions on what triggers investigations, with limits on who can start an investigation within the military service, with the whole notion being that this was an intention to reduce the anti-gay and lesbian atmosphere, all those things together, I think, will make it very likely that you'll see far fewer gay men and lesbians victimized by the policy. But it's still an inappropriate policy. And in particular, I didn't like the formulation that the president used, that we needed to strike a balance between letting gay men and lesbians serve and the need to keep the military in good shape, because I don't regard those as conflicting objectives.
Have you seen the RAND report that the Pentagon commissioned that concluded that gay men and lesbians could serve openly in the armed forces if that policy was given strong support from the military's senior leaders?
I have seen a summary of its conclusions, and I do believe that it ought to be released. There is absolutely no reason whatsoever for the Pentagon to hold it up. The RAND Corporation is a group that has a long history of working very collaboratively with the military. They are not people whom anyone has ever argued had an anti-military bias. The fact that RAND said that, it goes back to what I said before when you quoted the president's statement that he had achieved the right balance between the needs of the military and the rights of people not to be discriminated against. And as I said, those are not things that are in conflict. And the RAND Corporation study says that, and many of us are going to continue to press until that is released, because this fight isn't over. This is step one.
What's the next step, then?
Well, the next step, there are several next steps that we'll be taking simultaneously. One, the court cases will proceed. There have been court cases that predate this, and the court cases will proceed. The administration presumably will have a new rationale in some of the cases, but those court cases will go forward. Secondly, there will be the implementation phase, and we'll have to see how faithfully the military leadership and followers implement a policy that is supposed to, according to the administration, mean less harassment and less oppression of gay men and lesbians. Finally, this will recur in the political situation. What we've got, and this is one reason why I think this was an advance, although it was far less of an advance than I had hoped. Until recently, we didn't even have the support to have a debate on this. This policy that gays and lesbians were excluded had really not been terribly controversial in the country. Some of us had been agitating about it, and we began to get Secretary Dick Cheney and even General Powell to acknowledge that there were some problems with it, Secretary Cheney in particular. But until Bill Clinton got elected president, this debate couldn't have happened. It has begun. The outcome at this stage is not a happy one for me, because the ban, in theory, has largely been kept in place, although, as I say, I think lessened in practice. But that's now a debate that's open. And we're not going to stop this. We don't do this in civil rights issues in America, whether it's race or sex or any of these issues. We often have to start with a small gain because encrusted and longstanding prejudices acquire a kind of a strength just from having been there. People don't like to admit that they've been wrong. People have unreasonable fears about people who've been discriminated against, and it takes a while to break them down. The Rand Report, I believe, will be helpful in that debate, and that's why I think it ought to be released.
It strikes me that you were in what might have been a very uncomfortable position for you. You've been really wanting a Democratic president in the White House for a long time. You supported President Clinton in trying to overturn the ban, but you think he accepted a compromise that didn't go far enough. In your book, Speaking Frankly, which was published a couple of years ago, you wrote, if someone were to write a musical about the Democratic Party of the last generation, it would be called How to Win Everything in Politics Except the Presidency. So how do you feel now that you have a Democrat in the White House and yet on one of the first big issues that he's been tested on, you feel like he went too far in compromising?
I feel very pleased that we have a president. You can't seriously be asking me if I expected that once a Democratic president was elected, everything would go exactly as I want. I mean, frankly, that's not a tough issue to deal with. Presidents have a lot of power in our society. They are necessary conditions for winning on big issues, but they're not sufficient conditions. Abortion is a very important issue to me. I think the right of a woman to be free from legal threat if she decides to terminate a pregnancy, that's a very important issue, and it's one that I've supported all my political life. Now, having Bill Clinton as president instead of George Bush or Ronald Reagan is a very great advance from that standpoint, but it's not everything. Despite Bill Clinton, we still had the House of Representatives adopt the Hyde Amendment, with which I very much disagreed, which says, yes, you can have an abortion if you are able to afford one, but if you are a poor woman on welfare, you can't have one, most likely, or it will be very hard for you to have one. Now, Bill Clinton being president didn't mean that all of the issues involving abortion got resolved, but it did make it much better. And I think that's the mature way to look at these things. No, the president being elected, who is of your party, doesn't mean you get everything you had hoped for, but it does mean significant advances. We are now debating whether or not there was any real gain in this policy on gays and lesbians in the military. I think the very fact that we have had the debate, and the debate was one in which the defenders of the policy were, in fact, on the defensive, that's a great advance. When we had Republican presidents, we couldn't even raise this issue. There are, of course, other areas, as I said, in the gay and lesbian rights area where Bill Clinton has been enormously positive, appointing people who are openly gay or lesbian to public policy positions, helping them get confirmed by the Senate. That's a great advance. Increasing AIDS research funding by nearly 25%, which Bill Clinton did. Some of the things that Clinton has done that have been very advantageous from my standpoint, people don't know about as much because we were able to do them, frankly, fairly easily. And inevitably, what happens in society is issues get attention not because of their intrinsic importance, but whether or not they're controversial. If something happens that's really quite important, but there's not a big fight about it, people don't pay much attention.
Do you think that there are special pressures on you in an issue like this pertaining to gay rights because you are gay and out and in the Congress?
Yes, I'm sure there are. One of them, frankly, is that people in the media only want to talk to me about gay rights, and sometimes I find that frustrating. Mm-hmm. Gay rights is a very important issue to me, and I work hard at it. I work hard on trying to alleviate poverty, on trying to cut excessive military spending, on trying to stimulate the economy through better banking practices. And in that sense, yeah, the danger, I think, is that people who are in my district will get an inaccurate impression, not through their fault, but through the media, which will focus too much on one part of what I do and give people the impression that the part is the whole.
I wonder if you internalize opposition on an issue like this, where you interpret it as homophobia if people are against changing the military rules on gays. If it's different from talking about, say, banking or an economic policy, if you feel that it's almost, you know, if it's more personal to you.
Well, you have to separate that out. I think that people are racist sometimes when they oppose things that are fair for African Americans, and I think sometimes people are anti-women when they block fair treatment for women. So Yes, this is more personal to me, and I may feel it more intensely in some cases, but I work very hard at not having that color my judgment. Questions of discrimination against gay men and lesbians are different than banking questions or housing questions, but they're not different than race questions or questions of sex discrimination. And I, all my life, and certainly all through my electoral career, have been very much concerned with discrimination. I've been a big supporter of the Equal Rights Amendment and very much opposed to discrimination against women. I went to Mississippi in the summer of 1964 to protest against the terrible oppression, the worst oppression in American history that we've seen against the black people of Mississippi. It was un-American the way people were mistreated there. I've been a strong supporter of the Americans with Disabilities Act. I've worked hard on behalf of people with mental illness. So in that sense, I think I can say that I've been fairly consistently outraged by unfairness. I really believe very strongly every American ought to be treated on his or her merits. And now, being one of two gay members of Congress who's been willing to get into the middle of this fight, yeah, that can sometimes generate some pressures, particularly in terms of media attention. But while I may feel oppression against gay men more being gay, I don't think, if you look at my record, you'll see that I have differentiated in my efforts to combat that kind of prejudice from my efforts against race prejudice, gender prejudice, or anti-Semitism. I'm also Jewish, and while anti-Semitism, fortunately, is far less of a factor in the society than it used to be, on those occasions when it is a factor, obviously that's something that also engages my interest very strongly.
I'm wondering if there are a lot of congressmen who'd come up to you and say, listen, I have nothing against gays, but we can't budge on this policy.
Well, it depends on when and how they say it. Not when, but what's the basis? I have colleagues who have said to me, yes, I think you're right, but I'm afraid if I vote that way, I will be defeated. Now, I lament that, but I understand it, and I think that's what happened this time. For instance, I think a number of Southern members of the House were boxed in when Sam Nunn took the lead. If you go back, when President Clinton, President-elect, or even candidate Clinton made this pledge, no one anticipated that Sam Nunn was going to become a crusader against the rights of gay and lesbian people, which he's become, and a very effective one, because he is seen as a leader on military issues, and as a Georgian, he's very prominent throughout the South. And I know there are Southern Democratic members of the House, white Southern Democrats, who have feared that if they were to vote with President Clinton on this, they could have electoral trouble because people would quote Sam Nunn against them. Now, I sympathize with that. I understand that. You can expect your colleagues to do a lot, but committing political suicide probably goes beyond that. On the other hand, when people come up to me, as they have, and said, well, I hope you don't take this personally, and they have just made virulent anti-gay speeches, that's nonsense. Of course you take it personally. And for people to make these kind of anti-gay remarks and then come up and say, gee, it's not personal, is either extraordinary stupidity or gross hypocrisy or, as in most of the cases of these people, some combination of the two.
My guest is Barney Frank, Democratic congressman from Massachusetts and one of two openly gay members of Congress. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Congressman Barney Frank is my guest. Can I ask you how life changed in Congress for you after you came out?
Well, life in general changed enormously for the better for me. Trying to compartmentalize your life was very, very difficult. In fact, look, a couple years ago, I found myself being accused of some things, a couple of which I did do, and I was stupid to do them, most of which I hadn't done, but because of the way I'd lived, I was even vulnerable to the slanders and the lies. All of those problems for me happened before I fully acknowledged who I was. Now life is much better. It's better in part because I've met someone who I can share my life with, Herb Moses, but it's also better because I'm not worried about, well, may I do this? May I do that? Can I go to this place? Should I answer that question honestly? There's a whole set of pressures about what do I tell them and what do I not tell them that simply dissolved.
What kinds of things are you talking about?
Well, if people ask you, what are you doing for the weekend? If people ask you, what are you doing tonight? If people ask you, well, are you dating someone? I mean, some of these most fundamental questions. People have said, well, why do you want to tell people about it? Well, I think if people stop and think, they will realize it is impossible, absolutely impossible, for anybody to maintain a close personal friendship or even a sort of a moderately friendly relationship with someone and not tell them about your sexuality if you're going to be honest with them. What did you do last night? What are you doing next summer? Who are you socializing with? Have you ever been married? I mean, there's a whole range of questions that we ask each other to which the answers are inevitably indicative of, in part, of one's sexual orientation. As far as the Congress is concerned, I must tell you that my colleagues in Congress have been, I believe, quite sensible and civilized about all this. One or two right-wing Republicans reacted in a personally negative way, and the need no longer to pretend to be polite to them is not something I miss.
Before you were out in the Congress, did you have to go through charades like taking women to political dinners and things like that?
No, I wouldn't do that. There was a period of my life when I did things like that, but it was before I got to Congress. When I came to Congress, I had decided I wasn't going to engage in that kind of activity. I did not, when I was in Congress, ever consciously or deliberately mislead people. I rather, for a while, tried to avoid the subject. And then I wasn't avoiding the subject. Then I was trying to socialize with other men in certain contexts when it might be the reasonable thing to do. But there was a tension because while I was doing that, I wasn't officially acknowledging it. And as you know, the press, on the whole, has this rule that if you don't acknowledge that you're gay or lesbian, they won't mention it unless you happen to get caught doing something illegal. And that has an unfortunate consequence because it means for a lot of the public, the only time they hear about people being gay or lesbian is in some unfortunate context.
Do you think a lot of people in the Congress and in the press knew but kept it private for you?
Yes.
You co-sponsored a gay rights bill in, was it 1973?
In 1970, I didn't co-sponsor it. I sponsored it.
Sponsored it. Okay.
I was the first person. I was elected to the State House of Representatives in 1972, and I sponsored the package of gay and lesbian civil rights bills, except we weren't saying lesbian back then. It was just gay civil rights bills. Lesbians were, in lawyer's terms, I guess, a lesser included category in that. But the lesser in terms of numbers, by the way, not in terms of inherent moral worth.
So what was it like to sponsor this bill while you were still in the closet?
Well, it made me very nervous.
Yeah.
It made me very nervous. But at the time, you know, you get into one of these sorts of things where it's like being in the old barbershop where you had mirrors on both sides of the wall and you get an infinite set of reflections. Well, people would say, well, wait a minute. If he were gay, he wouldn't introduce that bill because then he would think we would think he was gay. But then other people said, aha, but if he was gay, he would introduce it because he would think that we would think that he wouldn't introduce it if he were gay because we'd think he was gay. So, and by the time people got through volleying that one back and forth, you figure the hell with it.
You're from New Jersey, right?
Yes, I am.
What I find, one of the things I find really interesting about you is that you sound so much like you're from the New York greater metropolitan area, and you represent Massachusetts.
Yeah, I do. You know, some people have different susceptibility to accents. I have an older sister, Ann Lewis, who many people are familiar with, and Ann is much more adaptable. When she lived in the South, you know, her speaking patterns changed. Mine haven't changed much. I don't like to think about why. Someone told me once, they asked Henry Kissinger's younger brother, and they said, well, it was his older brother. He said, you and Henry both came here from Germany, and you've lived here the same amount of time, and in fact, you were older when you got here, and still is. How come you have no accent, and Henry still has an accent? And he said, well, that's because I listen to people. And so maybe Anne listens better. But no, my accent has sort of stayed that way. And within Massachusetts, look, I think we sometimes stereotype the voters unfairly. We talk about stereotypes. By the normal standards, I think there would have been reasons why voters wouldn't have voted for me. And I have found sometimes people in my business think that you have to approach the voters in a certain kind of circumscribed way and sort of abide by certain unfortunate rules. And my experience has been in Massachusetts that that people are, in fact, much more open to differences of a superficial sort and much more willing to listen if you talk honestly to them. I have found people not insisting that you agree with them on every issue or that you be like them in every surface way, as long as they think you're being honest and they're fundamentally in agreement with you.
One last question. Do you feel that this was an issue in which you were differing from a lot of gay activists because you were recommending more of a compromise than a lot of activists were willing to accept? Is this one of the few times for you when you have felt that you were perhaps at odds in a way with gay activists?
No, not any more than a number of other areas. In principle, I have been, and in goals and in the fundamental moral stance, I am on the same side. But I often find myself, and you alluded to my book, which I appreciate, although I did see it remaindered in the bookstore in Boston.
Terrible feeling, isn't it?
Well, it's a year and a half old, so it was a fairly topical one. But I do feel that there's this unfortunate intellectual dichotomy that people subscribe to and shouldn't, between those who are idealistic, that is, who are committed to accomplishing a set of public policy goals, who believe that it's important to be in politics because you want to change things in a certain philosophically determined way, and those who are pragmatic, those who worry about outcomes. I don't understand that distinction. I literally don't. I mean, I understand that as an empirical fact, but I reject it logically, because the more you are concerned with changing public policy to accomplish certain values, then it seems to me the more you are obligated to worry about how effective you are. Because if politics is about important moral and value-laden questions, which I believe it is, then you're obligated to try as hard as you can to fix it. But unfortunately, there is that distinction. So I have often found myself, frankly, more concerned with kind of moral goals than some of the other people who are interested in the political pragmatics, and more concerned with trying to achieve outcomes than some of my friends who have a very strong moral sense. So it's not the first, and I'm sure it won't be the last time, that I found myself sort of resisting that dichotomy and to some extent disagreeing with people who took either one or the other side of the picture.
Barney Frank, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Barney Frank is a congressman from Massachusetts. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.